Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life is produced by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, a division of the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences. Visit us online at whyradioshow.org.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. Today, we're talking with our guests, George Lakoff and Mark Johnson, about the influential book, Metaphors We Live By. Words matter. We all know it. If we sometimes forget, we're reminded when someone calls us something that misdescribes us. Maybe we're referred to as Mrs. instead of Ms., or Ms. instead of Doctor. Maybe we're called Black instead of African American, or disabled instead of someone with disabilities. These words can sting, even if the speaker has only the best intentions. Words also make us uncomfortable, which is why we have euphemisms. Our loved ones pass away or leave us, but they don't die until long after the rawness of their passing has faded. And of course, many feel the need to avoid direct references to the body. We make love and we use the restroom. Plumbers talk about removing lady products from clogged pipes. Our words reveal our intimacies, our economic classes, and our insecurities. But how deep does language go? Is it really just a bulwark against social impropriety and political sensitivity? Or does it help frame who we are and how we think? How much does language construct our reality? How much does it define what we see and how we hear? These are the questions of tonight's show, particularly the roles that metaphors play in how we frame ideas, make logical connections, and choose to act. We'll be answering these questions by revisiting a 35-year-old publication, Metaphors We Live By, a book that helped us understand that word choice was more than just poetry or rhetoric, but indicative of the very way we conceptualize ideas. These are all questions in the philosophy of language, a collection of debates almost as old as philosophy itself. Plato wanted to define philosophical terms. He sought clear accounts of the meaning of justice, love, and the other virtues. Aristotle wanted to categorize knowledge in grand lists. Augustine, Maimonides, and Ibn Rushd were all concerned with the literal or figurative use of biblical language. And Hobbes thought that morality was the simple conversion of the words I want to the term good, a relativism that led Nietzsche, 200 years later, to question the foundation of religion, ethics, and equality. But it wasn't until the 20th century that language became the center of all philosophical discussion. Could a picture communicate ideas, or did we need words? Was a single word enough to get the idea across, or do we need a whole sentence? Can we reduce language to logic like we could math? And if so, could we create an ideal language? Do exclamations like ouch have the same values as the clause snow is white? And what about propositions like there's a God? If the existence of God could never be verified, did this lack of proof mean that asserting God's existence is nonsense? Poetry gone awry, gobbledygook, so familiar that we only imagine it has meaning? There were even philosophers who thought that language was the prerequisite for thought itself, and that if we didn't have language, we couldn't actually think. This means, of course, that most animals were deemed incapable of thought, but it also had profound implications for people who couldn't communicate. Under this way of thinking, the miracle worker didn't just give Helen Keller the ability to speak. She gave her the ability to think. She welcomed her into the human community. These are great debates, some, in my opinion, more valuable than the others, but they can all be reduced to the very basic questions. What's the purpose of language, and what is its relationship to thought? An irony, though, is that despite its linguistic precision, despite its profound role in educating and motivating the imagination, poetry was the great blind spot of the 20th century philosophers. Poetic language is rarely direct. It circles ideas as much as it focuses on them explicitly. It evokes feelings through association and insinuation. Its sentence structures mimic thought, with lines of broken text and intuitive but grammatically questionable punctuation. It reflects the internal experience of ideas, but not the precise concepts that philosophers thought were necessary for clarity in thought. And so some philosophers dismissed poetry along with euphemism, allusions, symbolism, and, of course, metaphor. These literary tools, they claimed, only had philosophical value when they were reduced to the perfectly grammatical, uninterestingly clear, literal propositions that were hidden underneath the poem. The flourishes of language obscured the truth they felt and did nothing to reveal it. Philosophy, many thought, should only concern itself with truth. I offer this history to emphasize that the attention we're about to give the philosophical importance of metaphors is, in many regards, revolutionary. It runs counter to significant portions of the philosophical teachings that educated most philosophers today. Or rather, I should say this focus was revolutionary. It's not anymore. The study of metaphors is now essential to all areas of philosophy, from symbolic logic to political philosophy to phenomenology to epistemology, a shift that couldn't have happened if George Lakoff and Mark Johnson had never published Metaphors We Live By. It's worth, then, taking another look at it, not as academics, but as people for whom metaphors are so commonplace that we don't grasp their influence, and as an audience who is so used to their multiple meanings that we may not see metaphors as metaphors at all. And now we turn to our guests. George Lakoff is the Richard and Rhoda Goldman Distinguished Professor of Cognitive Science and Linguistics at the University of California, Berkeley, and Mark Johnson is the Philip H. Knight Professor of Liberal Arts and Sciences in the Department of Philosophy at the University of Oregon. They're the authors, together and separately, of more than a dozen books. George and Mark, thank you so much for joining us on Why.
Good to be here.
Pleasure to be here.
The show's being pre-recorded, so we won't be taking questions live. But if you'd like to join the conversation, please visit our chat room at whyradioshow.org, post on Facebook at facebook.com/whyradioshow, or tweet us at whyradioshow. So, George and Mark, I guess the shortest way to summarize your book is to say that the metaphors we use, the language we rely on, helps create our way of conceptualizing the world. But before we get to explaining what that means, I have to ask, what's happening in the academic world in the 1970s that you both felt the need to argue this? Take us back to where it all began.
Maybe I could start. This is Mark. Maybe I could start saying a word about philosophy, and George could take it from there. When George and I met in the late 70s, we had this strong sense that there was something profound about metaphor and the role it played in our understanding of the world in every aspect of our lives. But we both came each from different traditions and disciplines, but we didn't have the tools to make sense of metaphor, and our backgrounds, our training, and the philosophical and linguistic schools had not appreciated the profound role of metaphor. And in philosophy, you had mentioned a kind of positivist background. I think I can sum it up in three ways, saying what was going on in philosophy that made metaphor seem unimportant. The first thing was what Richard Rorty called the linguistic turn. And he's essentially right about that when he says that Anglo-American analytic philosophy focused in the 20th century, it's focused on language. And the idea was, I think it's a mistaken idea, but the idea was that all experience, all thought, all meaning, and all communication are mediated by language. That was the first assumption. So what was philosophy? Philosophy's linguistic analysis. If you want to understand how we make meaning and what our concepts are and even the nature of the world, you have to analyze language. The second thing they piled on top of that, and it was a kind of narrowing of philosophy even more, they said that language, that meaning was basically presented to us in what we called propositions, kind of sentence-like structures like all men are mortal. And they consisted of concepts that get put together by, logical connectives. And then those concepts, if we're going to have knowledge or understanding, have to map onto the world and in a direct way. And so the third thing they added to that, another narrowing, was they said, well, so if you really want to have knowledge of the world, if you want grounded truth claims, you have to have literal concepts. So there's no place for metaphor in this picture. Some of them said metaphor was a kind of emotive expression. And others said, well, if it has any meaning at all, it has to be reducible to literal language. So when I met George in late 70s, I was struggling with the philosophical tradition that really had dismissed metaphor and had no place for it.
Before we get to George, let me ask, wasn't there a sense that all philosophical problems, all real philosophical problems, were really problems of language? And if we could clean up the language, the philosophical problems could go away. But metaphors make language more complicated rather than more simple.
Yeah, there were two parts to this. One was you could clean up language. This was called the ideal language movement. So that language was messy, but we could kind of analyze it into what its real meaning and its conceptual structure and its logical structure. And the other part was called linguistic philosophy, ordinary language philosophy. And it said, well, we don't have to have an idealized language, but we do need to understand how language works in the speech act communities, the speech communities that we're a part of. But they both shared the idea that you were going to get at the fundamental structures of thought entirely through these language-like, sentence-like constructions.
George, is this what was going on in linguistics too, or was the linguistic world a whole different animal?
Well, yes and no. I got into this through the study of grammar. I was an early student of Noam Chomsky's and, learned how that was supposed to work. And that was supposed to work by the idea that language is a matter of pure form, that it was simply a matter of symbol manipulation and using only other symbols. And the symbols were taken as meaningless in themselves. They might be given meaning, but any rule of grammar or of language would have to be simply meaningless.
Could you give an example of that? Because it's fairly technical.
Well, this came from an idea in logic. In the 1930s, it was shown that there were things called formal languages, which was a metaphor, where you could do symbolic logic, for example, or other kinds of computational mechanisms by simply having symbols that move things around. In computer science, for example, the symbols are 0 and 1 and strings of zeros and ones. And those are taken as symbols, but they don't mean anything in themselves. They have to be, quote, given meaning in some other way, and they only operate in terms of other symbols. And the idea behind generative grammar was that language itself worked that way. The assumption was that a sentence was simply a string of symbols, that a language was a set of such strings of symbols, and that a grammar was simply an algorithm for generating that set, which is a formal mechanism that, came out of the work of Emil Post in the 1930s. Now, that idea fit with the emerging idea of computer science, which also has the same kind of idea. So it got very popular in the late 50s, early 60s, and so on. And, after I got into this, I had been studying both mathematics and poetry and literature. It became very clear with examples that I found that this couldn't work, that there are all kinds of cases where meaning entered language necessarily. And I started, writing about this. But at that point, in the early 60s, meaning meant logic. And logic had two parts. One was deductive logic, which was the formal system of, setting out propositions where you start out in formal terms and then you go step by step, as in Euclidean geometry. But then those things, symbols are meaningless. They have to be, quote, given meaning. And that is done in logic by what is called model theory. Model theory says that assumes a structure of the world, which was goes back to Leibniz, which assumes that the world is made up of objects, properties, and relations at any given time, that that's all there is, and that you can model this with sets of elements of a certain kind, and that you can then map the sequences of deductive logic, that is, these strings, onto those sets of elements, and then they would fit the world. And that's the assumption behind that. So the idea of language as fitting the world goes along with that. And the primary person in the 20th century responsible for this was Bertrand Russell. And the ordinary language movement was a reaction to Bertrand Russell.
I have to interrupt and just say that this sounds as far away from poetry and metaphor as you can get. And it sounds like defining poetry purely in terms of iambic pentameter and nothing else.
You got it. And this is a very important thing. You know, I was studying poetry at the time, and the linguists who wrote about poetry mainly wrote about things like iambic pentameter and the theory of metrics and things like that, or sound theory, but nothing about meaning at all.
And, you know, in philosophical aesthetics at the time, there was this fundamental distinction that was made between – so there's what they called emotive meaning and cognitive meaning. And all the stuff George has been talking about, they'd call cognitive meaning, where you have descriptive sentences that are either true or false, and they consist of concepts that map onto the world or they don't. And they said, well, they didn't know what to do with poetry, and they didn't know what to do with art. So they said, oh, well, I.A. Richards had in The Meaning of Meaning in 1923, along with Ogden, said that all poetry is just an expression of emotion, and it doesn't have anything to do with stating truths or really giving you an understanding of the world or your life. It was a very misguided view, but it took over and it made for the dismissal of poetry as a serious topic, basically, in philosophy.
So for our listeners, I want them to imagine they're not allowed to say, ouch. They can only say, I am in pain. They're not allowed to say, I feel blue. They can only say, I don't even know how to, you know, you can't even say, I am sad, because you not are sad, right? You exhibit these expressions. So by limiting the language to this in this way, philosophy and linguistics is taking away an essential humanness. So what happens? Was there a particular metaphor? Was there a particular moment? Was there something that was a wake-up call for both of you that said, hey, we need to talk about metaphorical language. We need to talk about multiple meanings at once and the way they interplay.
Well, there were a couple of such moments for me. After working, trying to work out a logic of natural language for over a dozen years, and it never did quite work. You know, you could learn a lot from it. You could learn what inferences were and how all sorts of technical things. And I learned a great deal from it. I greatly respect logicians. I think that logic is a great part of mathematics. But it didn't work for natural language. And the what happened in the 1970s, and especially around 1975, a number of people who were at Berkeley independently discovered cases where language was thought was embodied. This was done in part by Paul Kay, for example.
And by embodied, you mean related to the physical body of?
Related to the physical body, but in all kinds of different ways. So Paul Kay, who was working on color terms around the world, he was an anthropologist, looking at what was regular about color terms. There are different color terms between English has 11, but there are some languages that only have 2 and or 3 or 4 or 5, and Russian has 12 for basic color terms. He was looking at that and putting it together with work by Russ Devaloy in neuroscience on the neurophysiology of color. And it turns out there's no color in the world. It's not out there. It's created in the following ways. You have wavelengths, but wavelengths aren't colors. They're reflected by objects. You have color cones in your eyes. You have neural circuits connected to those color cones, and those neural circuits create color. And not only do they create color, they do it in more ways than one. Men and women don't necessarily have the same kinds of color cones. They're considerably different. Color cones for men and women. And so if you have an argument about whether something is green or blue, you know, with someone of the opposite gender, or whether it's orange or brown, you're both right because you're seeing different colors. Colors are created by your interaction with the world. They're not just out there. Now, this didn't fit the idea that you could say something like the chair is green, where the chair was in the set of green things in the world, because there is no set of green things in the world. That showed that the science was showing that this view of language in terms of fitting the world in itself wasn't going to work. And then there are other results having to do with that. Eleanor Ross showed that there were what are called basic level concepts. So you can get a mental image of a chair. You have a motor program for sitting in a chair. You can pick out chairs at a distance by gestalt perception. But in general, you can't do that for furniture. There's no general mental image for general furniture, for tables and chairs and lamps. They're all different.
So you're actually speaking about a moment that I think is really important because it counters what a lot of people think of in terms of the sciences and humanities today. They think of the sciences and the humanities as in opposition to one another, and people go to the humanities if they want to work at McDonald's, and people want to go to the sciences if they want to work on technology. But what you're suggesting is that the scientific discoveries said that we needed metaphors, that we needed the humanities, that we needed this language structure that was more complex because color was not in the world, color was with us. And so we needed this other structure that described the human imagination, the human experience, and that the humanities and sciences are much more intertwined than people necessarily believe.
Exactly. And, you know, I went to college and studied English literature and mathematics both. And I saw them as the same thing. And when I wound up writing a book with Rafael Nunez on the metaphorical structure of mathematics, we showed that effect. It was true.
And, you know, I think one thing George is – I mean, what he's basically saying to me is what happened was a kind of revolution in the 1970s. All of this empirical work – too many philosophers were doing their armchair linguistic analysis, but – we in the 70s, we started to get all this empirical work that called into question the fundamental assumptions that some of which we've laid out that were governing philosophy in some parts of linguistics. And it meant that you had to have a complete, really top-to-bottom rethinking of what meaning was, for example. And so one of the things he's suggesting, I think, is that meaning reaches down into the bodily, visceral depths of our lives. It's not yes, it's manifest in language, but it's manifest in many other ways, and it's not linguistic as such. And that meaning, human meaning, and understanding and reasoning are far more complex and far more deeply embodied than people had recognized. And once you recognize that, you've got a lot of work to rethink a number of important topics.
Exactly. And a couple of years after that, when I was teaching an undergraduate seminar, we were reading an article by one of the philosophers who was saying metaphor had to have literal meaning. A young woman in the class said, "Hey, you know, my boyfriend just said something that was an interesting metaphor, that our relationship had hit a dead-end street. You know, and he's thinking in terms of this metaphor." And we said, "Okay, what is this metaphor?" And we looked at it, and there were lots of expressions in which love was understood in terms of travel, like, the marriage is on the rocks, we're off the track, we're going in different directions, we may have to bail out, and so on. There are hundreds of these things. And then we looked at it, and we saw that there was a systematic relationship, that in these cases, lovers were travelers, that the love relationship was some sort of vehicle, either a car, a train, a boat, whatever, and that in general, the idea was that in a love relationship that's long-term, it's like you have to reach a goal together, you know, and the difficulties were difficulties in travel, like we're spinning our wheels in this relationship, the marriage is on the rocks, and so on. Now, these things, we worked that out. They were regular, systematic relationships, and I started writing them down. And what they did was map what are called frames onto other frames. A frame is a mental structure for understanding any kind of situation that you understand at all. And travel is one such situation, and love relationships are another such situation. And there was a systematic mapping from one frame to another frame. Then, and what happened was that the reasoning about one frame, which we'll call the source, was used to reason about the other frame. Travel, reasoning about travel, was used to reason about love. But and that was remarkable. That was not supposed to happen, according to the philosophy and linguistics of the time.
This is a great moment of suspense and a really good time to take a break. When we come back, I'd like us to go directly into the consequence of this realization and to talk about what you argue in Metaphors We Live By, and particularly the sort of paradigmatic argument that you start with, which is argument is war. We are talking to Mark Johnson and George Lakoff about Metaphors We Live By. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We'll be back right after this.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
We're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We're talking with George Lakoff and Mark Johnson about Metaphors We Live By. You know, when I started reading the book again and started thinking about it, I came back to an experience that I've had over and over again. When I started grad school, I was not just in the philosophy department, I was in another program called the University Professors Program at Boston University. And we all had to take this seminar for new grad students where each of the professors gave one class on their work. And there was a guy, I don't remember much about the class, honestly, and there was a guy who I don't remember who was talking about metaphors. And I was interested in political philosophy and I was interested in justice, and it didn't register to me. I remember nothing about the discussion except this one line where he said, "The fundamental problem with metaphors is that it's both a truth and a lie at the same time." And I remember thinking as a young grad student, that's dumb. I'm not interested in this. I don't know why I'm sitting here. It's not an obvious observation. And I have to say, and this is, I'm not exaggerating, that I have probably thought more about that sentence in my philosophical career than just about any other sentence that I've heard in any classes. And if I could go back in time and listen to that whole discussion again, I think I would learn a great deal from it. I think this is illustrative of the fact that many of us just don't pay attention to metaphor and the idea of metaphor unless we're thinking in terms of literature. Mark, George, You start the book by hitting us over the head, pardon the metaphor, with an attention-getting metaphor that we think of argument as war. And philosophers in particular are immersed in this notion. Can you talk about why argument is war is so important and how it represents your overall argument in the book?
Can I say one thing about you was talking about this moment when we realized the kind of, not moment, but this period when we were realizing the profound importance of metaphor. And I wanted to add one background bit of information, and that is in your introductory remarks earlier, a listener might misunderstand you as saying, well, metaphor is a linguistic device that has profound implications for our lives. And that's not what George and I were claiming.
And that's the huge revolution, right?
That's revolution.
The big point.
We're claiming
Absolutely right. That
a metaphor is conceptual, but it reaches down below language so that metaphor is manifested in all aspects of our life, and it's in, you can see metaphor in art, in spontaneous gesture, in dance, in architecture, and yes, in poetry and in linguistic presentations also. But our insight, I think, was grounded on this recognition that metaphor is one of the most profound and exciting structures for any kind of abstract thought that we have. in all these different dimensions. And so when we started out with argument with war is war, that was just a good example that people, I think, can relate to where, you know, the language of shooting down an argument, you know, that kind of thing. Well, yes, that's in the language, but the metaphor is not itself linguistic. It's that we're understanding argument at a deep level, and we're engaging in it as if, you know, in the reality being we are attacking the other. And George and I suggested that there might be alternative metaphors that could be more constructive or cooperative for thinking about argument.
Not only that, we did notice that, but we noticed something deeper that came from, Marx's background in phenomenology, namely that when you look at the up and down metaphors, where you have up and down being there are many, many metaphors where up and down is a source and, you know, like more is up, less is down, turn the radio up, stocks went up, and things like that, versus I'm feeling up today, where happy is up and sad is down. If you look at happy is up and sad is down, it's in your body. It's in the way right. You smile and whether you, how you stand and what your posture is and so on. It is deeply embodied. And then if you look at more is up, why is that the case? Well, every time you pour water into a glass, the level goes up. You pile more stuff on your desk, the level goes up. All the time, there's a correspondence in your experience, in your everyday physical experience, that corresponds more with up. Now, what has happened since then is that all this has turned out to be neural. And that's a very important thing. One of the things that was very important about early linguistics in the 50s and 60s.
And just to interrupt, by neural, you mean having to do with the cognitive structure of the brain. We're talking material here.
Not merely the brain, but the brain extends throughout the body.
Okay.
The brain is not just in the head. Most of the brain is actually in the rest of your body. Hmm. There's a neural system that, you know, runs, you know, down your spine through every place in your body where you can feel anything, inside or outside, is connected directly to your brain. So that you think in terms of the total neural system, not just the brain. Think of it this way. If thought were just in the brain, what would it be about if it were not connected to the body? It couldn't be about anything. You know, this is a very important thing. If you knew the entire connectome of the brain, you would know nothing about how thought works.
So this actually relates to one of the advanced questions we got from a listener, Brittany, who asks, in what ways do you think the natural world influences the metaphors we create about ourselves? And so what you're suggesting is that there is a physical and a natural relationship between the orientation metaphors, the ups and downs, both because of the way our body exists in the world, but also the way that cups fill up. It is inherently connected to nature and our experience.
That's correct. And not only that, our bodies are connected to the world in certain ways. We have parts of our brain that are linked between vision and the motor connections. And so when we see someone else writhing in pain, we can know that they're writhing in pain because what we see is connected to what our body would be doing, and that is connected to our emotional regions. So we can feel other people's pain, and that's a real thing. And not only that, we can also look at objects that we look at. You look at a glass filled with water, and you know that you can pick it up and drink it because what you see is connected to your motor regions. So this is a very deep thing that was discovered back in the early 90s in Italy at Parma. And it's a very, very important discovery.
And for us, this is what to really talk about the embodiment of meaning. And this is the key notion here, that human beings are complex organisms in ongoing interaction with environments, and that the whole arc of meaning comes out of those patterns of interaction. And they have affect or feeling and emotion as fundamentally part of it, and the fact that we're interested animals, and all of that contributes to what can be meaningful to us. So we're taking the embodiment of meaning and the deepest, most profound sense, and saying that metaphors are connected into those connections, that experiential correlations, and those are grounded in neural connections, and that in turn is connected to the body's mode of interacting with its world. So that we're trying to overcome a deep dualism, a mind-body dualism, and say that really there's an ongoing organism or body-environment interaction. And now we have some neuroscience and other tools to study just how that works.
Well, let's take a step back and let's go back to the book, because I do, before we're done, want to talk about the advances. But I think that since most of our listeners haven't read the book, I think let's spend a little time talking about what you meant by saying that metaphors were a conceptual structure and that they were systematic, that they were really essential to how we thought and how we connected our thoughts. What does it mean to say that metaphors were more than just language alone, and that they were really about how we conceptualize the world?
Well, first, remember that most thought is unconscious. 98% is unconscious. The reason for that is that we think with our neural circuitry and we have no direct access with it. Consciousness is about 2% of thought, and it has very special properties. The assumption before all of this came about was that thought was conscious and that you could see it in language. Now, language gives you definite evidence for the nature of thought and the nature of unconscious thought, but that evidence was not really looked at. And the evidence came from the systematicity involved. In general, when I was talking about the Love is a Journey case—
By systematicity, you mean the connectedness of it all.
The connectedness between the source domain of travel and the target domain of love, where you have lovers are travelers. That's systematic. The relationship is a vehicle. That's systematic. Difficulties in the relationship are difficulties in getting to life goals together, having the same consistent life goals. Those are part of a systematic understanding of that metaphor. So it's not a matter of just random things. We're just putting things together or putting words together randomly. Quite the opposite. We have in our brains stored, if you want to use the metaphor of storage, but they're in the synapses of our brains, thousands of learned metaphors that we use unconsciously most of the time to understand the world. That is what we found.
Can I make an addition about the notion of systematicity that George was drawing on?
Sure.
Let me give an example. One of the early metaphors we analyzed is what we called understanding as seeing. So you've got seeing, the vision is the source domain, and understanding is the target domain. And think about what's in the source domain, like George said about the love is a journey metaphor. In the vision, in the understanding is seeing, you've got an object that's seen, you need a light, there's visual acuity, you know that if something blocks the object to be seen, you won't be able to see it. So there's a systematic structure to the source domain, that's one. And that gets mapped onto a target domain. We use that systematic structure to understand and think about understanding. So we say, I see what you mean. That was an illuminating remark you just made. Could you shed some more light on that? And notice, the language we use is light, illumination, illuminating, that sort of thing, an obscure vision language. But here, it's manifesting underlying a metaphorical conception of something that is not vision itself, understanding. And so that's the systematic mapping we're talking about. And you get the whole logic, all of your understanding of understanding via that metaphor comes out of the systematic structure of the source domain.
And you can show the systematic structure in cognitive science.
Right.
That is, you can actually write down the structure of the source domain in terms of what is called frame semantics. You can write it down. You can write down the structure of the target domain in frame semantics, and you can actually show that there's a correspondence between one and the other, and that the source domain has a logic, it has inferences, and those inferences are carried over by the same mapping to the target domain. This is a technical thing, and it can be written down.
So for our listeners, what you're suggesting is that what it means to understand something is so intrinsically related to this notion of seeing that we have in cartoons when people have an idea, a light bulb comes up.
Yes.
Religious folks will say, I see the light. And that if we had a different metaphor, we would have not just a different language, but a fundamentally different understanding of what it meant to understand. And what comes to mind is in Robert Heinlein's Stranger in a Strange Land, the main character who's half Earthling and half Martian. In Martian, understanding is tied in with drinking. And so there's this whole passage that I remember from when I read it years ago that that knowledge is something that you consume rather than something you see. And I assume that that has roots in not only Plato but in Egypt and thousands and thousands and thousands of years, right? It's not something that was decided by Disney or anyone like that.
Right.
But in fact, it's been shown that that it is deeper than that. Eve Sweetser showed that there is a super metaphor, a higher metaphor even than understanding is seeing, in which you understand thought itself as a bodily process, where the mind is a body functioning in space with respect to things that are out there. And there are four parts to this metaphor that she pointed out, and they are that one is thinking is moving, where you reach conclusions. You go directly to that, or you think in circles.
Have steps in an argument.
Exactly. That's one of them. Another one is that thinking is eating. It is, consuming ideas, as in that drinking case. But, say we don't spoon-feed our students.
Right, of course, right.
We have raw facts, half-baked ideas, warmed-over theories.
Exactly.
We say we can't digest that.
And another one really important is that ideas are objects that you can manipulate and toss around. And that goes along with the idea that communication is sending objects from one person to another. So, that came through to me. The meaning is right there in the words and so on. These are very, very important structures that we have. There's this super metaphor that the mind is a body functioning in space.
So I'm sorry to interrupt, but why do we need multiple metaphors? Why can't one metaphor do the job? Let's limit it to understanding as seeing and not complicate it with understanding as consuming or understanding as thinking as motion. Does that suggest an inconsistency, or does the
No.
multiplicity bring us additional things?
You're thinking it's the wrong question, because you're assuming that communication and thought is a matter of simply achieving purposes rationally, and that's not true. It's neurally that's what's really important. What Srini Narayanan, who is probably the world's expert on neural computation, discovered back in 1997 that, there were neural circuits that could be modeled very, easily that carry these things out. And since then, one of the things he found out is that the metaphors that are involved here are what are called primary metaphors that use concepts that are around in everywhere in the world that are there in your brains. And that the mechanism is really a mechanism at the level of neurons, the level of neural learning. The idea behind this theory, and it's now we can go through the evidence for it. There's a lot of evidence for it now. But the evidence behind it is this, that in the theory, there is a mechanism called spike time dependent plasticity at the level of neural learning. What that means is
I have no idea what that means.
I'm about to tell you. When I first heard it, I said, "What is that?" You know, but it was discovered about a dozen years ago in Geneva, and by the folks who are in charge of the the major brain projects in Europe. And what they found out was this. The idea is this. Why is it that when you have a correlation in your experience, say between quantity and verticality, why should that lead to a metaphor? And the answer is a very interesting neural answer, where you have things like affection is warmth. Why should that be a metaphor? You have affection, you have warmth. What do they have to do with each other? And they have everything to do with each other. If you're held affectionately by your parents, you feel the bodily warmth. There's a correlation in your experience, just as there is with quantity and verticality. When that happens, they are both registered in your brain. Whether you are conscious or not of these things, your brain notices, and that is activated in your brain. When circuits are activated in your brain, they become stronger. Every neuron's connected to 10,000 others, and they expand, they activate along existing pathways. What happens is that as they repeatedly correlate with each other, those pathways are filled with more and more connections that spread as far as they can, and they get stronger. And in the brain, there's always pathways from one place to another, and what happens is the shortest pathway is formed. When you form that shortest pathway, you get a circuit. But the circuit is going in both directions. When that happens, this mechanism of what is called spike time dependent plasticity takes over. It says that the direction in which the neurons are firing first, most of the time, is strengthened, and the other direction, the synapses are weakened. And what that does is give you an asymmetric neural connection. That asymmetric neural connection in these cases are what are called primary metaphors. They're the metaphors on which the entire system of thousands of metaphors are based. There are just probably only several hundred of these that we have found so far. But, and there may be more. There may be, 1,000 or something. I doubt that there are that many, but I don't know. We've only found a few hundred so far. And
And can I go back to Jack's question, though? Like George said, there was some assumption about the question. Why do we have all these different metaphors for understanding, like understanding is touching and understanding is seeing, et cetera? And why don't we just get our act together and get them reduced? That's the old literalist idea. We're going to get them down to one basic concept. But that's precisely what doesn't happen for human beings, for the reasons George says. It's the way that we're, you might say, wired up as embodied organisms, that we're going to the world does not simply come presented to us with all of its structure fixed and complete. It's based on our interaction with our environments and the way and what our environments afford us. And so we have different perceptual modalities, and we have affective dimensions of understanding. So we're going to get, just by living in the world, multiple primary metaphors. And for a single domain like understanding, it's just a fact about us that we're going to have multiple metaphors emerging for understanding the phenomena. There's not going to be one literal, unified conception. And that's a profound truth.
I want to point something out to our listeners that has been an interesting experience for me as the host so far in this conversation. So many of the answers to the questions that I've asked are connected to contemporary debates about cognitive science, about neural networks, and the original book didn't have any of this language at all. It predates a lot of this stuff. So any of our listeners could pick up Metaphors We Live By and understand it. It is incredibly clear, incredibly patient, wonderfully well written, and really explains metaphors in and the conceptual systematicity of metaphors in a way that is very intuitive, I think, to almost any reader. What's happened in our conversation, though, is that we're tied into so much new and interesting and compelling research. And so I guess the question I want to ask, especially for people who want to go back to the book, is does this mean that the book itself, Metaphors We Live By, is I don't want to use the word obsolete, but that the picture is incomplete enough that it doesn't do the job anymore that it was set out to do, or is it just a different way of presenting material that is entirely consistent with the more cognitive science based stuff that you're talking about, even though it predates those discussions? How does the book itself fit into the new language and the new discoveries that point to a new attention to materialism, a new attention to physicality that represents the world that we now talk about in the last, let's say, 20 years or so?
Well, the book is entirely consistent with what's been found. What we found was basically right. It's just that we know a huge amount more now scientifically. And not only that, the book is the best introduction there is. It's still the best introduction there is.
Let me say something. When I went out to Berkeley in 1979 and met George on the 1st of January, and we started talking about metaphor, and we decided we needed to spend more time talking it through. And we started writing, and back then, of course, we didn't have the neuroscience of this. So that's what you're talking about, I think, right?
Right, is absolutely.
That we analyze these metaphors and we set them out systematically without really doing some of this technical stuff that we've been talking about recently that's developed after that. And I just wanted to say a word about that. I mean, literally, George and I would sit next to each other in his study at his old Smith Corona electric typewriter, and he'd start a sentence and I'd try to end it, and then he'd change that, and we would simply start saying, look, how do we think about understanding, and we'd see that there was an understanding as seeing metaphor, and then there's understanding as we'd think about thinking. We started saying, what's the language? And so we did start with language. That's true. We'd say, what's the language that we use to talk about thinking? How does that manifest any of these underlying metaphors? So we started kind of phenomenologically there, doing what linguists do and trying to find generalizations over the phenomena. Why do we say about a relationship, look how far we've come? That's a thing you could say literally about a journey. Why can we say that about love, a love relationship? Look how far we've come, dear. It's off the tracks. And so that's where we started, and that's accessible to anybody, I think. That's one of the things that makes the books pretty accessible. And you start to – the excitement of it, that we call this a kind of journey of discovery for ourselves, is that everywhere we looked, we found these metaphors structuring our understanding. And all of the – I would say all of the intense neuroscience and all has come later to try to fill out that picture.
And this is what I referred to in a conversation with my wife before the show as the coolness factor of the book, right? I'm reading these things. I'm reading Time is Money or the discussion of personification, like life has cheated me, inflation is eating our products, the dollar has been destroyed by inflation. I'm just sort of randomly opening the book. And I just think, cool, I talk like this. I write like this. I think like this. And so what's super exciting about the book is just that experience that everyone I know who's read the book has had, which is they see themselves in the book. It is not foreign. In any way, it is representative of people's actual thinking and actual experience. So I guess the question I have then, and especially since all the new discoveries, does this mean that the metaphor of warmth, say, as affection, affection as warmth, is that universal? Does every culture share this primary metaphor?
So how
does that work then? How does the cultural variation work when there is this experiential, scientific, neurological component?
It fails in Tamil, which is in equatorial India, where the temperature is 120 degrees. It doesn't work. There, warmth is annoyance.
Oh, that's interesting. That's, of course, that makes perfect sense.
Right, exactly. The theory works. The particular examples of the theory vary with your experience. And I want to say one more thing about philosophy. We have another book called Philosophy in the Flesh, which is an easy-to-read 600-page book. But
right,
honestly,
it's very big.
But it's really easy to read. There's nothing hard about it. It's just a matter of it's long. But what we sat down and I asked Mark, what's a philosophy? And Mark went and he figured out what the structure of a philosophy is. A philosophy has to have a method. Well, we have a method. It has to ask about certain concepts, namely time, events, causation, the mind, the self, morality, and being. Okay? And I said, well, we've actually studied many of these. Let's work the rest of them out. And then the question arose, well, what are philosophers doing? And Mark, being a remarkable historian of philosophy, went through and he said, hey, look, each philosopher is using some subcollection of metaphors that they're taking literally. They're taking these metaphors as if they're literally true, and then they're working out the details in great details because every metaphor has inferences. And this book, half of the book, is just detailed metaphors, the most basic metaphors that we have. Then you can pick it up and just read those things like metaphors we live by. But the second half goes through the history of philosophy, showing how the history of philosophy has to do with philosophers choosing among the existing metaphors they already have, picking some that they take as literally true, and then working out the details.
You know, this is it's fascinating to me because, in a certain sense, what's happening in our conversation and what you just described is an essential tension in the public philosophy project that we're engaged in right now. How do you have a deeply conceptual, philosophically sophisticated conversation in such a way that anyone can participate and that anyone can follow, regardless, as we always say, regardless of credentials? And part of what I think maybe the metaphors do, and tell me if I'm wrong, is they help define who's going to understand it and how they understand it, and that they're primary metaphors that are wider ranging and can have a wider audience. And then there are narrower metaphors, which are either cultural or a specialized community like philosophers or linguists or computer scientists. And so part of what we call specialization tell me if I'm on the right track. Part of what we call specialization is adherence to and an understanding of a selective set of metaphors.
Right. Right.
That's exactly right. It's true in politics. I now have 7 books on, conservative versus progressive politics showing exactly what those metaphors are. And there's a book on mathematics, another easy to read. I hate to say this, but 600-page book, but it's fully detailed and it is easy to read. And what it shows is that how we understand infinity, how we understand the Cartesian understanding of space, understand numbers as points on a line in one case. In other cases, numbers are sets. Those are different metaphors. They have different consequences. And even things like Georg Cantor's understanding of infinity and levels of infinity come out of a basic metaphor of Cantor's.
And this isn't just like George says, it's in mathematics, it's in politics. There's work on metaphors in architecture, in dance, metaphors of spontaneous gesture, of ritual practice. You know, we've got now 30 years of intense work showing that what you said, Jack, that these are the very means we have for getting meaning and expressing meaning and communicating meaning in all of these practices of our lives. And I want to say something about what you said about philosophy and public philosophy, because I think it's very important. When George and I wrote Metaphors We Live By, our fundamental thing, George sat me down and said, I'd written something. He said, well, Mark, this is beautiful philosophical prose. Now we got to change all that.
That's the story of my life.
He said that because I had learned to write as a grad student at the University of Chicago these long Germanic sentences right. that were very nuanced and, oh, they're so wonderful that they capture all the nuances. But he said, we got to speak to people straight out. So and it was very important. And we wrote this book. And one of the criticisms of Metaphors We Live By was it can't be serious. It doesn't have footnotes.
Right.
But we were trying to speak directly to people in a broad general audience. And I wanted to say one thing about a problem that's emerged. Over the years now, all of this cognitive science has developed. And as you can tell from listening to George talk a little bit about some of the neuroscience, it's very difficult. And like he's writing, he and Srini Narayanan are about to come out with this amazing book on the neural theory of language. And the challenge is, how can people understand? How can you present the neuroscience and the other cognitive science and the cognitive linguistics in a way that's accessible to the general public? And we're profoundly aware of that. That is the big struggle. And the early work, Metaphors We Live By, we were able to, I think, present the phenomena in a way that people could resonate bodily with it. And, when we both had this experience hundreds of times. You get up and you give a talk on metaphor. The next person who gets up to speak, they'll start to talk and then they'll stop and laugh because they recognize that they're using a metaphor. That's what you were talking about, Jack. You know that's actually operating for you and you start to see it, and that's the kind of aha experience. But trying to get scientifically sophisticated at that gives us a real challenge for presentation, I think.
There's another thing that's really important that needs to be said here. There's a wonderful book called Making Truth by a very noted chemist who points out, he goes through 8 branches of the applications of chemistry, showing that they're all metaphorical in great detail. And that is the case. Science itself is using metaphors all over the place. And the question is, can you get beyond it, or is it possible to get beyond it, or should you? Is that the best way to understand the world?
I'm glad you brought that up because I have these voices in my head right now, metaphor. My best friend Gail, who I can channel after 30-some-odd years of friendship, and she's sitting here listening, asking, well, what metaphors are there in science? Science is free of this. And my friend Ryan, who's a mathematician, is sitting there asking, well, what's the metaphor in mathematics? So can you give us a couple examples of the scientific and the mathematical metaphors so that people who are still a little skeptical and who are really look at that kind of discipline as independent of metaphor, what can you show them to give them the aha moment that so many people have had with the book and with your other books?
So think about string theory. Think about space-time. I mean, we understand, you see in Metaphors We Live By that every language has a way of understanding time in terms of space, where things are coming toward you, the time will come, the time is long since gone, or we're moving over time, we do things within a certain amount of time, etc. We understand time in terms of space and motion in the world. And what Einstein did, and also true in Newton as well, but Einstein said, look, it's not just space-time. If you take four-dimensional mathematics, what you get is the possibility of curved space. And what he argued was that time, space and time are joined together in one idea, but that the mathematics is based on curved space. If you look at his account of gravity, it has to do with that large entities with a lot of mass create curvature of space, and that objects moving along through space follow the shortest possible path, even if it's curved, and that gravity is simply curvature in space-time.
Can I interject one thing? Here's another very simple example I think everybody can get, is that I did some work with a psychologist here at the University of Oregon who works on attention, on metaphors of attention. And what we saw was that scientists, the actual experiments and the grants they get depend on which metaphors they use. So we have, everyone will know this, you have a spotlight metaphor for attention. Metaphorically, it's almost, there's this thing, the mind, and it shines a spotlight on an idea object. And then there's another metaphor, it turns out, that's a kind of an evolutionary theory, but it says attention is a limited resource that has to get allocated. And these are two fundamentally different metaphors. And we went through the scientific literature on attention and showed that different contemporary theorists are using these different metaphors and that their experimental design is set up on the basis of the metaphor. So that's a good example of how you can't do without them in science.
So we have two different things going on here. We have the curved space metaphor, which if I understand it right, space is nothingness, and nothingness can't be curved. So what you have then is a metaphor to help us understand the mathematics, the relationship between bodies, the waves, and all of these things and their behavior. And we understand it metaphorically because we can't conceive of nothingness, but we think of curved as an essential quality of space mm-hmm. when space is nothing or the location for all of these interactions. And at the same time, it's not just the conclusions that we're deriving, but it's the method and the way that we think about science and the way that we present science. And so if our attention is limited, that means that when we write our grants or when we present our papers or when we give lectures to or have discussions with audiences, we have to highlight certain metaphors because there isn't enough space or enough tension for anyone. And you give a really interesting example of this in the book where you talk about inviting someone to a dinner party. And you say that you can describe this person as a sexy blonde, a renowned cellist, a Marxist, or a lesbian. And that they can all be true, but whichever you decide to focus on is going to give the most mm-hmm. You're going to focus on this one thing. And so if I understand you correctly, scientific method works exactly the same way. It's about choosing the metaphor that focuses on the point that you want to make at any given time.
Exactly. Think of the Higgs particle, where you have a Higgs field. Now, there's a very strange idea in the Higgs field. The Higgs field is a field that says energy isn't empty, the universe isn't empty, that space imposes energy at each point. It's an energy field just as there would be an electromagnetic field. But then it talks about when a particle enters the Higgs field, it gets mass, right? And the question is, what is meant by that? That's a remarkable metaphor, and what does it mean if the universe is filled with energy? How can a particle enter it? I mean, these are interesting ways in which the mathematics that is being used is trying to be understood in terms of our ordinary metaphors.
This is, I think, another kind of metaphysically profound point. I had this lame idea many years ago. I had this naive view about science. Well, we know what the phenomena are, and then we have theories to explain them, and then their theories compete. And that's just false. What I discovered when I did the psychology of attention work was that the researchers do not even agree about what the basic phenomena are. And so and we saw that it depended how they broke up the phenomena or individuated them depended on which metaphor they have. I'll give you one example. And if your eyes are focusing on some object and you're going to go object A and you're going to go in a second, you're going to turn your attention to object B. It's kind of like the spotlight's going to move. Well, there's something that a psychologist called covert orienting, and that's that you've already started to pay attention in a sense to the second object before it's actually consciously focused on. And the question is covert orienting part of the phenomena of attention, or is it background and something else? And it turns out that the answer to that depends on which metaphors you've got. And so it's not even that the world's just out there and then we come to explain it. Like you said, the metaphors that we're operating with determine what's going to be important, how we're going to understand it. It has implications for how we go forward in our lives, as you said, when you gave the example of the dinner guest.
So for the folks keeping score at home, so to speak, if you read the book, you see implicit responses to Kant and his notion of causation as part of the manifold. You see Hume. You see all of these different things. You have a discussion of what it means to understand something and what it means for a sentence to be true. So for people who really want deep stuff, especially later on in the book, it's in there. I think what our listeners tied into that are probably asking at this point is, okay, if the metaphors define what we decide to focus on, the phenomena or how we analyze them, then what's the implication? Is there – it's a two-part question. Is there an objective world, right? And you address this in the book, but I want to ask you here. Is there an objective world, and what does it mean for something to be true if human beings are fundamentally metaphorical animals, as opposed to, and here's a technical term, as opposed to people who are engaged in a correspondence theory of truth, where traditionally, historically, for a long time in philosophy, truth was I had this idea in my brain, and then there's the reality outside, and something is true if the idea in my brain matches the thing in the world. And a metaphorical human being, a metaphorical understanding, has elements of that but can't subscribe to that notion. So is there an objective world, and what does it mean for something to be true for a metaphorical human creature like a human being?
There is an objective world, no question about it. People are dead or not dead, you know, for example. No question about things like that, although the issue of life and death and when you become dead is tricky because it's not so simple. Okay?
Right.
So that is the case. But also, there is an objective world. However, it doesn't come categorized in human categories. You know, we are trying to constantly make sense of the objective world in terms of our embodied brains and minds. Our embodied neural systems, and we make sense of it in multiple ways. A lot of that sense is made metaphorically. And you see this in mathematics. You know, people say, well, what do you mean in mathematics? You know, we have, you know, things are there, one or two or three objects out here, you know, blah, blah. It's very simple. Not so simple. In order to see one, two, or three objects, you have to have a part of your brain that has neural circuitry that allows you to see it, and we know what part of the brain that is, and there's a theory of what that circuitry looks like. But then the question is, what happens with infinities? How does that work? What about the foundations of mathematics? There are different versions of it. There's a set theoretical foundation where numbers are sets. There's a geometrical foundation in which numbers are points on a line. There are many, many other kinds of foundations of mathematics which define numbers in all kinds of different ways, and they have different properties of the numbers. Numbers are not just simple things. And you see this in things like imaginary numbers and all kinds of other very interesting metaphorical notions of numbers that define different branches of mathematics. This is all in the book Where Mathematics Comes From, which I wrote with Rafael Nunez. And we showed also that there isn't one notion of infinity, but there is a metaphor that gives rise to the concept of infinity that comes out of everyday experience, and that all of the different versions of infinity are different special cases of this one metaphor, a sort of a general metaphor for infinity, in terms of the way that we use our bodies to understand what is going on in the world. This is not obvious, and it's in the book and described in detail that can be understood. But, you know, it takes a while. That's why it's a long book.
You know, can I try this for 1 second? It's the idea, because this is really deep to me, because we're getting back to this question, well, is there this objective world out there? And when George says, well, there is an objective world, I think what we're saying is of course there are energy fields and things are in interaction. But when we're talking about human thought and understanding, we're talking about how organisms like us structured the way our brains have been wired up, et cetera, and our bodies. How do we engage that world in a way that we can make sense of it? And I've used the idea of an affordance from J.J. Gibson, the perceptual psychologist. I see a chair sitting across from me, and it affords sit-on ability. Why? Because there are certain structures in the environment that are fitted and they're so structured that they're fitted to the body I have, my ability to bend my body, the size of my body. Whereas for an elephant, it doesn't really afford sit-on ability. And so what is the world? Is the chair a fundamental object in the world? Well, it is relative to people like us. The world doesn't come with its ultimate description inscribed on its sleeve, I want to say. It's a matter of we have purposes of inquiry. We have purposes for acting in the world. And so the reality emerges in and through that process of interaction. And the metaphors show us some of the structures of those interactions.
Okay, so we're just about out of time, and I want to ask you both, what's next for Metaphors We Live By? I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, you know what I'd love? I'd love to read a book called Metaphors We Still Live By, and integrating the chapters that exist now with the neuroscience that you're describing so that I can see even better how it interrelates. But that's just what's in my head. What's next for the book? It's clearly going to have a life for a long time. What do you see happening with it?
I think it's just going to be there as a monument. We've added an afterword. We may have a second afterword pointing to the work on the neural system. That could happen. We could have a second, a neuroscience afterword. But, that points to other things. We can have something pointing to how this explains the major divisions in our politics right now. We can have a little section that says, hey, here's how that one works. You could always have a couple of more afterwards, but I think the book by itself still stands. And I want to say one thing. We messed up in one analysis because we didn't know enough. The argument is war idea is based on a more general metaphor. That argument is struggle. As you see, every time you are trying to feed your six-month-old baby, something, and they don't want to eat it. And they say, yes, you're going to eat your spinach now, or yes, I'm going to pick you up now, or now you have to get your bath. And there's a struggle. The argument is struggle is there, and war is a special kind of struggle.
And I was going to add, for me, I always want to ask, well, what difference does this make for how I live? And this takes me back to the old, Socratic, know thyself, the Greek, the Delphic oracle, and know thyself. And to understand how these metaphors profoundly affect the way we interact with one another, and you see this in Donald Trump politics and that sort of thing. And so George has done all this work on the political implications. We've analyzed some of the metaphors for morality. And I think that's the real payoff for people's lives is trying to understand both what makes us who we are and also where other people are coming from, and that there are these multiple perspectives. And it's led me to rethink my whole idea of meaning, too, I have to say, to understand that meaning goes much deeper than language into the visceral depths of our existence. And it's opened up ways of looking, as I said, at the arts and architecture and ritual practice and gesture and that sort of thing, and understanding the and seeing that the metaphors are operative there too. And so there's a huge amount of work that's mushroomed in the last 15 or so years, exploring some of those more non-linguistic dimensions.
Well, I think that's a wonderful place to stop because it gives us a tremendous agenda for the future. George and Mark, this has been unbelievably interesting, and I learned so much more than I had anticipated because the book obviously is just the tip of the iceberg. Thank you so much for joining us on Why.
A real pleasure, Jack.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Jack Russell Weinstein, George Lakoff, and Mark Johnson on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll be back right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Why Radio Store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
We're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We were talking with George Lakoff and Mark Johnson about Metaphors We Live By, a classic book that changed the way we think about language, understanding, and the relationship between the words we use and the way we know the world. You know, this was one of those shows. I went in thinking we were going to talk about one thing, and we ended up talking about not something completely different, but something that described itself in a very different way. I thought we were going to talk about metaphors as language and the tension between truth and fiction. But what we ended up talking about was neuroscience and the way the body relates to the world. The insight of the book, the insight that George and Mark brought with them, is that those two things are the same thing. That we can't talk about our language and metaphors and fiction and poetry without describing how our body exists in the world. We can't talk about the way we communicate or the way we understand without talking about our experience. And that involves our neural network. That involves our brain. It involves our body. It involves our unconscious thinking. It involves a whole host of things. What the conversation necessitated was going back to the 1970s and a time when language wasn't taken as anything but a direct description of the truth. How do you strip away all the excess stuff and get to the truth underneath it? What Metaphors We Live By did was say, hey, that's not quite right. The human experience is a lot more than just truth. The human experience is understanding, it's fears, it's love, it's stories, it's rituals, but also the human understanding understands truth in a much more complicated way than people then thought. And so in the last 30 some odd years, that insight has gotten us not just to talk about metaphors as texts, but talk about the way that our bodies describe, create, respond to metaphors. That's a deep insight. It's a profound insight because, as we talked about in the show, it means that the line between the humanities and sciences, it's not finer than we thought it is. It's pretty much non-existent. You can't talk about science if you don't talk about literature. You can't talk about philosophy if you don't talk about poetry and you don't talk about math. It's all one. Human knowledge is one. The human experience is one. That's what makes metaphors so rich, because they come with all of this stuff that we have to grasp on a thousand different levels. It's what makes the human experience so rich. It's what makes human knowledge so difficult. As we walk away from the show, think about all the metaphors you use, and don't think of them as imprecision. Think of them as a gift that represents how deeply human beings are intertwined with the world around them. You've been listening to Jack Russell Weinstein and Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. As always, it's an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. Skip Wood is our studio engineer. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua y Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.